The growing sophistication of fake news. Fake news became a household phrase during the last presidential election, as stories with absolutely no basis in fact began to explode in popularity on social media sites, such as Facebook and Twitter. In the years since, the phrase has been used to describe everything from elaborately detailed fake news videos to simple news items that someone in power doesn't particularly like. And almost every day, fake news is making real news. In the past week, Elizabeth Warren's campaign tried to make a point by posting a fake news item on Facebook claiming in the headline that Mark Zuckerberg was endorsing President Trump. Then there was the fake video showing President Trump slaughtering journalists. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Some fake news is outlandish and easy to spot. Some, not so much. Have you ever been tricked? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Before we talk about today's topic, which is fake news, we're going to get a quick update on the fallout from the big storm overnight from my colleague, Fred Bever. Fred, what is the latest on power outages across the state? Any sense when people are going to have their power restored?
Well, the answer to the second is no, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that in a minute. Right now, there are about 220,000 people without power, or residences and businesses without power in the state. Most of those are in Central Maine Power's territory, about 174,000, with another 40,000 in AmeriMaine's territory lacking power. Cumberland County was really the hardest hit, with tens of thousands lacking power. York, Sagahawk, Lincoln counties also were fairly hard hit.
Okay. I know that 2 years ago, the state experienced a similar windstorm, and there was a lot of criticism afterwards of how CMP responded. How is CMP doing this time around? I know it's early.
Well, they have put in place a fairly robust team to respond to this storm. That judgment is according to the public advocate, Barry Hobbins. He also said to me today that he had just had a call with Doug Herling, the CEO of CMP, a level of communication that he had not seen 2 years ago. The CMP tells me they've got 100 in-house line crews in place. They've got 100 external contractors in place. 200 out-of-state crews are coming in to help with the cleanup and restoration. Right now, they're very focused on taking care of down power lines and taking care of the safety issues. They're trying to work with municipal officials to identify where those scenes are and then get to them, make sure they're safe, and then start going to work to actually restoring the lines that have been down and getting rid of the trees. Also, right now, CMP is reporting there haven't been any significant safety incidents, so that's a good thing. In terms of comparing to 2 years ago, you know, one thing is this storm was much shorter duration, apparently, compared to sort of the day-long surge of winds that we saw around Halloween of 2 years ago. So that's making a difference. CMP is certainly alert to its reputation being somewhat at stake here after the PR nightmares it suffered, both in the aftermath of that storm and with subsequent billing issues that some people have experienced working with CMP. They did have one embarrassing glitch, and I think they'll admit it was embarrassing this morning when many people went to see what the restoration time might be on the online web portal. It reported that the restoration would be January 1st, 2068.
I saw that on Facebook, yes.
So, and one of our colleagues saw it when she went this morning to see when she might get her power restored. CMP spokesman herself, Catherine Hartnett, told me it was a ridiculous thing. It was up for about 2 hours. They took care of it, and they're investigating why that happened.
Fred, I know that you spent a good part of the morning out and about, especially in the greater Portland area. What did you see?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time in the Falmouth area where there were dozens and dozens of trees down, sometimes three in a row, like dominoes. The CMP had mentioned to me that the ground is soft at this time of year. There's a lot of leaves on the trees. You get wind surges up to 60 miles an hour. In the middle of the night, trees go down. They take wires with them. So when I was out, work was just beginning. I talked to the fire chief, who I met on a street out there. He was manning a barricade. He told me that Falmouth had run out of barricades because there were so many streets that they needed to close off for safety purposes. And it was a real maze of cars trying to figure out their way to get out from their homes to their workplace. I also went down to some of the marinas off of Yarmouth and Falmouth and Portland. Many boats broke free of their moorings in the storm. The Falmouth harbor master told me that there were 16 of them in Falmouth alone, the most he had ever seen. I spoke to a couple of sad boat owners who were on the shores, sort of scanning the horizon, seeing if they could find their boat that had parted its mooring lines.
Wow, and I read that the wind speeds were at the Portland Jetport among the highest ever recorded, top 10.
It fortunately didn't sustain for so long that this was more of a disaster than it seems to be at this point. But of course, restoration is ongoing. CMP says it could be late this afternoon at the earliest before they start trying to report just high-level restoration times.
Well, Fred, thanks so much. And I know you're going to be reporting all afternoon. That's Fred Beffer, reporter and producer for Maine Public. Now turning to today's topic, fake news. It comes in many forms: false headlines, doctored photos, doctored videos. Today we're going to talk about the prevalence and dangerous potential of fake news to influence what people believe. Joining me in the studio, Chet Lunner. He is a former journalist and Maine newspaper editor. He's also served as a congressional chief of staff, 9/11 press secretary, homeland security intelligence officer, and other positions in the federal government. And joining us from our Bangor studio is Jeannie Borgo. She's president of Internews, a nonprofit international news organization. As always, we want to hear from you. Have you ever fallen for a fake news story? Do you have questions about social media's role in the dissemination of fake news? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Thank you both so much. And Chet, I think really a good question for this discussion to start with is, what is fake news? And I know that seems like a silly question because it means news that's not real, but we have a president who regularly on Twitter calls all sorts of things fake news. What is your definition?
Well, that's a great place to start. And I actually turn it around. I know what news is for sure. And I'm actually not fond at all of the term fake news. Here's why. There's real news, and then there's propaganda, rumor, satire, lies, slander, gossip, talk radio, innuendo, hoaxes, unconfirmed reports, opinion, hearsay, public relations, commentary, rhetoric, and supermarket tabloid headlines, which is where I get a lot of my news. I am really sort of disturbed when I hear it used so cavalierly, that real news is somehow mixed in with those definitions. We should be more precise about what it is. And it's no wonder that people have a trouble defining it because it's used way too widely.
But for the let's move back then for the topic of, you know, for the purpose of today's discussion, let's talk about the news that is intentionally generated without any basis in reality. And there does seem to be an explosion of these news stories, mostly on social media, but in other places as well, that just are just patently false. The person who created them not only created them to be patently false, but tried to make them look or feel like a real news story.
Well, I agree. And, you know, some of this goes back to third grade, when you can recall the latest gossip got everybody excited and interested, and whoever was telling it was very popular for the moment. And I think there are human beings who I heard someone describe the other day as a professional attention getter, who just can't stand not being in the limelight, and they'll say anything or write anything or produce anything that keeps them in that position. There's this sort of a celebrity status that comes with being the source of these things all the time, even though fake news, which generally has intentionally misleading information for some third purpose, even though that's clearly not reliable, people do it because it makes them, in a sense, very popular.
Jeannie Borgo, I want to bring you into the conversation. This is not a U.S. problem. This is an international problem. Yes?
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, misinformation, disinformation, malinformation, these terms we've been using for a long time in much of the world. And I would say that the implications and impact for much of the world is dramatically worse than what we're facing in the United States. If you look at a place like Myanmar, where deliberate disinformation campaigns have led to the Rohingya crisis and an exodus of a people from a country, and people are calling it genocide, and it is directly rooted in deliberate disinformation campaigns.
You remain an optimist, though. A lot of us feel overwhelmed, frustrated, just so discouraged by the proliferation of this, especially those of us who work in, legitimate journalism operations outfits. Why are you optimistic that fake news is kind of not going to continue to cause such horrible disruption?
Well, even though it's really, really complicated, there are solutions to it as well that are growing and proliferating around the world. And that's what makes me an optimist. My organization, we're not actually a news organization, but we support news organizations all over the world so they can achieve their maximum potential for the communities that they're serving. And so we're really trying to build the skills for them to do a better job with it. But we see four solutions to the disinformation fake news problem. One piece of it, reason it has become such a huge issue is because of the new social media platforms, obviously. They have just such a giant amplification effect. And research has shown that a piece of disinformation can reach 1,500 people 6 times faster than a piece of accurate information. It is just more popular, as Chet was saying. So those platforms have an accountability issue that the governments can help hold them accountable, but they themselves can hold themselves accountable. People can hold them accountable. So tech platform accountability, training in critical thinking at the school level and at many, many different levels, starving the fake news. A lot of it is based on trolls, and there's a whole market out there, and people aren't doing it just for political reasons, but they're doing it to make money, and they can, but we can starve those trolls. And the most important one, and the one that I think Chet would totally agree with, is invest in real news. Invest in real, trusted news. That's the most critical element to solve this problem.
Chet.
And when Jean talks about the problem being showing up in a worse results overseas, I'm sure she understands or might have been thinking about the situations in India. She mentioned Myanmar, where the fake news doesn't just make people uncomfortable or tilt the political scale. People are killed. They die as a result of the mobs that form around these rapidly spreading rumors.
Right.
And it's a very serious problem in places where people don't have really alternatives. And these developing countries, there are no existing newspapers or other news sources. So, whatever shows up on your phone is gospel, and people act on it in very violent, very extreme ways.
I read this morning that we're going to be seeing during this next election cycle videos that don't look doctored,
right,
that look real, that's where technology is now, and that it's going to be almost impossible to distinguish what's a real piece of video and what's fake. Chet, have you seen this already?
Yeah, I think that's where the term deepfakes first came about. It's the video version of fake news, which are, there was one currently in the headlines that shows a scene from a movie where there's a mass shooting of people in a church, and it superimposes Donald Trump's head on it. Now, this isn't designed, this is to carry that message, not necessarily, it's one step short of actually, you'd swear it was Trump doing it, or in another recent case, former President Obama making a statement that he never made, you'd swear it was real. I mean, the technology is just getting scary.
Jeannie, is your advice? Go ahead.
I was going to say, to prove that, again, internationally, this is sometimes a lot worse already. Already in the country of Gabon, a disputed deepfake video contributed to an attempted coup in that country. So exactly the Obama example happened in Gabon, and it led to an attempted coup.
What tools, Jeannie, would you say that those of us having this conversation today, people listening to this conversation, might have in helping them figure out what's real and what's fake?
The issue of investing in critical thinking by the consumers of information is really complicated. There are lots of different pilot projects and different attempts to capture this. A real solid way is certainly at this education and the school level, weaving these types of critical thinking into your broadest curricula. But that's a really long-term approach, and we see that a lot of the problems actually end up coming from people who are newly coming online, which is often elderly populations and things like that. So that's the long-term educational solution has some limited impact. There's a lot of fact-checking going on, lots of fact-checking organizations out there. Again, it's a little bit unproven about how effective they are. And one of the challenges with that is that rumors and lies reinforce your own preconceived notions of things. And so even if somebody's saying, hey, that's not true, if you think it's true, it's going to deepen your conviction that it's true. And so there aren't easy solutions. There's lots and lots of experimentation going on. And that's what we're putting our money on is that experimentation with the fact checking, with the deeply embedding in curricula, and then reaching some of these populations that you're not really thinking about who really, really need it, particularly people newly coming online.
And I would add to that, my little slogan on this topic is, the answer is in the classroom, not the newsroom, that people as young as possible need to start learning their civic duties, A, as Americans, become and stay aware and knowledgeable citizens. You really have a sort of a civic responsibility to do that I'm not sure is emphasized much in schools anymore. And then to sharpen our ability to serve the kids or develop media literacy, where there are ways to spot it. Just, if you're trained to do it, you and I could certainly, as having been in the business long enough, you're just suspicious about something. We have to teach people how to do that and there are curriculum offered that are free and online from places like the Newseum in Washington, D.C., or the Poynter Institute. And if that fails, then there's also a new effort by Stephen Brill and some others to operate this thing called NewsGuard, which puts sort of it's a red, yellow, green rating on anything that they see online that will validate the trustworthiness of that information. So there are things available off the shelf right now.
That's true, and we need to, of course, reach children. But the reality is that this is all flying around right now, instantly. Yeah. And, I think both of you probably know people. I have friends on social media who are intelligent, thoughtful people who have shared fake news. Just in the last 24-hour cycle, someone I know shared an article that said Nancy Pelosi had taken money from Social Security to pay for the impeachment inquiry. Another friend of this person's debunked it, but his response was, it could have been true. And so isn't that part of the problem, that there's confirmation bias going on? And if something, depending on what your political leanings are or what your life experience is, seems like it could be true, maybe your guard is down a little bit.
There is a psychological element to this, and it's the confirmation bias you speak of is certainly in play in many of these things. Because they're not provable. When I was a reporter, the standard for writing something in a story was not only that it was true, but it was provably true. So you can't even if you believed it and it looked obvious, you had to get backup information. That's not happening, and we need to go back to those standards.
Jeannie?
Yeah, I was going to say it. What happens is sometimes deliberate disinformation becomes more casual misinformation because people share it so much. So they may not be deliberately trying to share a lie, but they just believe it, and so they're sharing it. And that's where we get that giant amplification effect on social media. And it affects things not just politics, but affects things like health outcomes. If you think about some of the vaccine debates in the Philippines, for example, in 2015, about 95% of the population supported vaccination. And in just 2 years, due to just misinformation, people putting out not deliberately doing this, but just sharing misinformation, it's gone down to 32% of kids are getting vaccinated now in the Philippines. And that's another area besides politics where the devastation of this is real and affects lives every day.
We're talking about fake news on Maine Calling. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, your comments and questions. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bull Moose, celebrating the tactile experience of reading and proponents of dog ears and bookmarks. Locations across Maine and at bullmoose.com. And Evergreen Home Performance, offering energy-efficient windows and insulation to help homeowners achieve year-round comfort. More at evergreenyourhome.com.
Millions of dairy cows produce milk in the U.S., but most of them are descended from just two bulls.
Everything goes back to two bulls born in the 1950s and 60s. Their names were Round Oak Rag Apple Elevation and Pawnee Farm Arlinda Chief.
How scientists are trying to diversify the gene pool and the latest on the impeachment inquiry this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's coming up today at 4 here on Maine Public Radio. It's not too late for your school to sign up for Season 4 of High School Quiz Show Maine. This fall, there will be a qualifying test to select the top 16 schools that will compete in statewide television contests broadcast next spring. If your school is interested, we'd like to hear from you. And now on Thursday evenings at 8, you can watch a rebroadcast of Season 3 on Maine Public Television. Information about High School Quiz Show Maine is at mainepublic.org. Just click on television.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are discussing the rise in fake news and the power it has to alter beliefs. Joining me, Jeannie Burgot, president of Internews, and Chet Lenner, former newspaper editor and retired executive. We invite you to join the conversation. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. I want to start with this interesting post on Facebook from Dan. Dan writes, "There needs to be legislation against spreading disinformation, penalties both for individuals and corporations." On its face, Chet, that may seem like a good idea, but there's a big problem with legislation, isn't there?
Yeah, we've traditionally stayed away from those people as much as possible for the separation of you hear about the separation of church and state, but the separation of newspapers and news media and state is also pretty important. But there is a way to do it, and I was just reading this morning about a settlement that someone has received of close to $500,000 for the people who against the people who had claimed the Sandy Hook kids were actors and all that. There was a fake conspiracy surrounding the Sandy Hook massacre. And so they sued them civically, not criminally, but in civil court, and just won. I would like to see more of that, and I'm surprised there hasn't been more of it in the past.
Sued them for slander?
I assume it was libel or slander.
Okay.
Or the effect that it had on their lives.
Mm. And Jeannie, I want to ask you, you know, here in the United States, there won't likely be legislation because of the First Amendment. What are we seeing around the world?
Oh, no, it has, again, another devastating effect around the world, amplified all the greater. I totally agree with Chet that government regulation is really problematic because it tends to lead to a rise in censorship. And there's a lot of countries around the world that love any excuse to censor. And so even our conversations about fake news, that term has become an international term. And governments all around the world are saying, hey, it's fake news. We're shutting it down. And that's what we're seeing. That's how it's playing out around the world. So we are fans of platform accountability, the platforms themselves taking more accountable control over their content, that public pressure, as Chet was describing, even through the courts, those are much better paths.
And it's no accident in the history of revolutions around the world that the first thing that the new government wants to do is take over the radio stations and shut down the newspapers so they can control that information. The flow of information is critical to us. We sort of take it for granted, but you can see it in those examples.
Well, let's talk about the social, you know, the pressure on social media platforms, because just last week, Facebook announced a change in advertising policies to exempt politicians and political parties from rules banning misinformation. Because of that, we saw Elizabeth Warren's campaign post a false headline as a challenge, saying Facebook ought not be profiting over, you know, from fake news, profiting from lies. This is something very much up for debate right now. Facebook is clearly, or at least at this point, not feeling the public pressure and saying this is not our job. Chet.
Facebook and the other platforms are really struggling with their role. In 1996, there was a law passed, the Communications Act, which granted them immunity from suits. We were just talking about the importance and how powerful a libel lawsuit can be, and that has kept newspaper and TV reporters and radio reporters on their toes for years, because you're responsible for what you publish. In the case of the Facebooks of the world, the federal law that addresses this was set up so that they had more freedom and flexibility, and they do not. You can't sue Facebook for something someone else puts on Facebook. Now, as part of this new discussion, like we're having here today, the Congress is looking at how to tweak that and make them more responsible. But the Zuckerbergs of the world do not understand how to be editors in the sense, or producers in the sense that we know from traditional media. They're still trying to figure that out. But Congress, I think you'll see them held more accountable.
We'll go to John calling from Portland. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Maine calling.
Hello. Yes, I called basically the mea culpa for yesterday spreading fake news, or one of the other terms that your guest would prefer to fake news. But it was some traditional media. I saw it first on Twitter, and then I found it on the Daily Mail, so I thought it must be legitimate. It was the statement that our president called the president of Italy, whose name is Mattarella, that he called him mozzarella. apparently that isn't true. And I repeated it on Twitter. I also called our president a triple nut biscotti. And the tweet was retweeted hundreds of times and liked hundreds of times. And then I basically came to realize it was most likely false.
Well, John, I appreciate your candor and your honesty and your mea culpa. It's a funny example, and it's not as dangerous as what Jeannie especially is describing. And I think there are probably lots of people out there who don't have the courage you have to admit that they have done this. But what John's talking about is just that, how quickly things can be magnified.
Exactly. And that occurred to me when he was speaking. And thank you, John, for your mea culpa. I wish more people would do that, too, is that the emphasis, one of the big problems with this generally is the emphasis on speed. You know, if I get something on my Twitter, then you want to turn it around and share it as rapidly as possible, as far as possible. In fact, the Pew Research Center has a study that shows unequivocally that misinformation and bad news, which is usually more dramatic than the real news, spreads further and faster than any other sort of information. So this emphasis on speed, which we didn't have in the old days, we had 24 hours to put out another new edition, has really magnified the problem in ways that I don't think people understand.
Sean, thanks for your call.
Go
ahead, Jeannie.
I was just going to say it also captures that issue about this current issue with Facebook, that they are uniquely different than traditional media because of that, exactly that factor. So as they think about allowing false political advertisements to go onto the platform unchecked, they're different than a broadcaster for exactly that reason. And we need to think about it much more critically than a broadcaster.
Yep.
We'll go to Ellery, who's calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead.
Hello, and thank you again for a wonderful, wonderful program. Quick story. About 40 years or so ago, in a science magazine, they put a composite photo on the image, image on the cover of the magazine, and under the cover, they profusely apologized for doing so. A composite of a plane and the sky together, because this plane hadn't flown yet, they didn't have images, so they put one, a fake one, on the image. So my question is, the fakes have been going on for around a long time, practically since the invention of photography, double exposures and whatnot. When did this become, I mean, the internet may be enhancing it, but it's been going on for a long time. When did this start becoming acceptable?
Chet? I think what Ellery's talking about is, you know, the changing images. You know, I remember there was a famous case in National Geographic moving a pyramid to fit into the the frame. But there's a big difference here.
There is, and it wasn't acceptable back in the Dark Ages when I was running a thing called newspapers. I remember people getting into trouble for just flipping the negative so that the face, you always wanted the face of your subject to look into the print, toward the inside of the newspaper for design reasons. And so sometimes editors would be tempted to flip, you know, a picture of Prince Charles looking at the soccer game so that he fit the page better, without altering it in any other way whatsoever. Even that was a no-no back in the day. As to when it started getting looser, I don't know.
We'll go to Sophie calling from New Hampshire. Hi, Sophie. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm a student at the University of New Hampshire. I'm studying communication, and I've been talking about this issue in one of my classes. One of the recommendations that my teacher gave me was that that people take individual responsibility and work as mediators. And I think maybe a social change in people correcting other people, because right now, especially with family members, it's such a hard issue, and it's very much of an issue where it's hard to address without it being acceptable to mediate or call people out for being wrong.
Sophie, I'm so glad you called, and I'm wondering if Jeannie or Chet, you have questions for Sophie as a young person studying this, as a young person who's grown up surrounded by social media.
What are you going to do with your degree?
I'm really thinking about just going in and helping people and facilitating and mediating sort of public discussions. I think definitely advocating for groups, especially in the mental health field, trying to advocate for them and sort of change the narrative of sort of neurodiversity and stuff like that.
Well, good for you, because and I think that you'll find that what you learn and the communications curriculum is going to be helpful no matter what you do. I have had a series of, it's an unusual collection of jobs and mini careers, and the common denominator for success was always being able to communicate well.
I think that Sophie brings up a really interesting point, though, too, because I think there's, again, a lot of experimentation that we can do in different ways of confronting this problem. We've seen some really fun projects around the world. There's some contests that communities can host that encourage people to try to identify fake or paid news content. And it does two things. One is people get really engaged in the process and they're really interested and are looking around for it so they can win this contest. And second, it unearths a lot of stories for the journalist and traditional media to cover, because they do uncover all sorts of crazy fabrications out there that show up in online or in traditional media. So fun contests, different ways of convening people to have conversations about it, all of these things really make a difference, I think, in that individual agency and your individual ability to navigate this new information environment that we're all living.
Sophie, good luck to you, and thanks so much for calling in. Jeannie, what do we know about how the proliferation of fake news has affected confidence in traditional journalism, traditional institutions? There have been studies about this, haven't there?
That's exactly right. The global PR firm Edelman conducts an annual survey of trust around the world. And for the last 4 or 5 years, they've seen a dramatic decline in trust for public institutions broadly and the media very, very specifically, up until actually this past year. And so we're starting to see glimmers of hope, because I do think we can only live under this environment so much. And so as trust is eroding, slowly people are starting to look for trusted voices again. And not surprising, they turn to scientists, authoritative voices, researchers, and the media. And so we're seeing a slow curve back towards trust, particularly for those types of institutions that have long had some trust. The decline continues for social media platforms. So we're seeing just a slight turn in the curve when it comes to trusting traditional media and authoritative voices.
A slight trust in the curve, but fewer of those voices to turn to, right, Chet?
There is, and in, what bothers me is that in my public speaking presentation that I do around the state, one of the slides goes to the most recent Reader's Digest poll of trusted people in the in our culture, and it, you know, back in the day, remember Walter Cronkite was the most trusted man in America, et cetera. And their presidents were very well received in that light. These days, the most recent poll they have, the most trusted person is the actor Tom. Help me out here.
Hanks,
exactly. Thank you. Tom Hanks is the most trusted man in America, and none of the top 10 people are either government officials or journalists.
Mm. Well, we are talking about the impact of fake news. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Jane and Frank Bragg of Bangor, proud to support the independent journalism and new voices of Maine Public News. And the Sunrise Guide, presenting the Green and Healthy Maine Home and Energy Show this Saturday at Portland's East End Community School. Tickets at greenmainehomes.com. On the next Speaking in Maine...
He talked about the kind of threats he was getting, but he was also heartened by the positive feedback he was getting from Saudis he never met.
Hear the 2019 Lovejoy Award panel discussion at Colby College, honoring the journalists who sacrificed their lives in 2018, with a focus on the recent PBS Frontline documentary on the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. That's coming up on Speaking in Maine, Thursday afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, epic storms, rising seas, and the cost of America's coasts. We talk with journalist Gilbert Gaul, author of The Geography of Risk. He writes about developers who create risky coastal housing and how federal subsidies encourage coastal development in spite of the risks, then pay for rebuilding when disaster strikes. Join us.
Fresh Air is tonight at 7 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are talking about fake news, how disinformation is created, spread, and how to identify it. Joining me, Chet Lunner, who is a former journalist and retired executive, and Jeannie Burgo with Internews. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Before we go back to the callers, I want to talk about something that just happened in the news. There was the video you mentioned, Chad, that seemed to show President Trump slaughtering journalists. You know, very disturbing. Some people are calling that video, and including the National Press Photographers Association, hate speech. And saying that it incites violence, the creators, I understand, are saying it was satire. And I know that this is a debate that's been going on for a very long time. Where do you come down?
It's very difficult. I mean, anytime you start to try to define what this is, what news is, what satire is, what commentary is, what fair use is, all of those things are really gray areas. And I think it comes down to more of a cultural, there's something hardening about our culture with this free-for-all that was not a part of traditional news publishing. We would have never have thought, even if we'd become the, you know, sole owners of that thing, we would have never published it in the days of traditional mainstream journalism. It just wouldn't happen. So it's, but
it does, yeah.
I think you've got to go in wanting not to do things like that, as opposed to going into the office wanting to do things like that. And that's a cultural shift, not something you can deal with legally by defining it more clearly. It's like, you know, it's art. You know it when you see it.
I was going to just jump in and say it does underscore a terrible sort of, in addition to this rise of misinformation, disinformation, fake news, propaganda, another giant challenge out there for the news media is the safety and security of journalists around the world. For the last decade, it has been declining. Murders of journalists for just doing their work has been on the increase. Journalists going to jail with complete impunity is on the increase for the last decade. And in fact, last year, the United States joined the top 10 list of one of the most dangerous places when it comes to journalists being murdered because of the murder in the newsrooms in Annapolis last year. So it is, there are direct real world impacts for that type of showing violence against journalists. It is happening really in the world, everywhere around the world.
Another dangerous element of this is the anonymity that social media has. When I was first starting out as a reporter, one of the best lessons I had was I'd cover the city council on Thursday night, and then Friday morning I'd be at a coffee table in the town, in the village cafe, with the same people that I had covered the night before. So you learn pretty quickly the impact that words, even accidentally, can have on another person, where and you're accountable for it face-to-face. With social media, nobody knows nobody.
We'll go to Randy, who's calling from Powell. Hi, Randy. Go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer, great show. I'm from Carroll Plantation, though.
Oh, wow.
We don't want to upset all 83 of us.
So, Randy, Carroll Plantation, tell us where you are on the main map.
Sure. You go up 95 till you get to the Lincoln exit, and then you head east on Route 6, and about halfway to the Canadian border, now a third of the way, you'll come to a little town called Springfield. Turn left, go past the fairgrounds, be on your right. And that dirt road right at the end of the fairgrounds, you go down there about 3 miles, and I'll put the coffee on.
Well, thank you. I bet you're a little past peak leaf season now. But what's your thought about fake news?
Sure. The thing is, you're on your Facebook, and you see a meme. Usually it's about some very, topical polarizing issue, gun control, abortion, or left versus right. And something just doesn't look right. Your fake news radar goes off. I go to Snopes. I go to factcheck.org, check it out, come back, and I tell my Facebook friend in a reply, geez, it's not right. Send the link, and, good on you. Some of them don't care. They're going to do the work of the Russian bots anyway, and they'll reply like, oh, yeah, wow, look at that. And they just leave it out there. And there doesn't seem to be any third-party mechanism if the meme or the post doesn't violate Facebook standards. You can't report it as this fake news thing to a third party so that they could correct it or what have you. So it's very frustrating because I take pride in not spewing any BS.
Yeah, Randy, I think that you bring up a couple of really interesting points. And the first I'll throw to you, Jeannie, which is Randy brings up a point that there are people out there who don't care if something is fake news or not.
Well, there's a couple of ways. There's two ways, I would say, to address that. One, again, getting back to the platforms themselves, the Facebooks and Googles of the world, and their own obligations, if they want to be corporate good citizens, is they can do a better job at burying these stories, and they should. They have the technology. They have the capability. So that's one piece of it. The other piece is the market itself, that we can starve the fake news market if advertisers and brands and the big investors say, we're done. We don't want, right now, digital advertising dollars are programmatically, automatically through algorithms put out there in the social media landscape. They have the ability to control that. They can start to say, no, we want our ad dollars to be directed at verifiable, trusted news sites, real news sites. And so there's a way we can start starving this fake news as well. And I think we need to do both of those things.
Yeah. And Chet, that's the second part of what Randy was saying, that when he finds out something's false, he wants there to be a third party he can report to. And it's a third party who might be able to actually do something about it.
Yeah. And they are trying that in Silicon Valley. Facebook has a whole set of fact checkers. Gene mentioned those earlier. And then there's a new level that they're putting together called the Oversight Board that will be there to even look at appeals of the fact checkers, should we post this or not. And so that which will not be connected directly to Facebook in theory. So there is an attempt now underway at some of these places, which again, remember, have never been required to do this, so it's all new to them, to put in some sort of oversight board that could do what the caller would looking for.
Randy, thank you so much for your call. And I think it's our first call from Carroll Plantation. Very fun. Thank you. We're going to go to Lawton in Penobscot. Hi, Lawton. Go ahead.
Hi. We're without power here, so I'm calling you on my rotary phone.
Oh, excellent. I have one, too.
I'd be right in.
Well, I'm glad you're listening on your battery-operated radio. Or is it a hand crank?
I got a dial phone and a battery-operated radio.
Okay. Go ahead.
I guess my question is, do your guests feel like we're getting close to a point where of no return, where it'll be really difficult to decipher the real news from fake news? You know, in the presidential question here, supposing Trump is impeached and there is evidence, there are a lot of people almost religiously that will believe, won't believe it. They will say it's fake news, it's the deep state, it's the liberal news media. How do we combat that?
I don't know that there's I left my crystal ball at home today, but it's hopefully nearer than farther that people will start to understand that it's more than money involved here. There's a commercial side to publishing news and the Facebooks of the world, which are sinking in money. And then there's the public service side of journalism and news. And I think that, as Gene mentioned, the market control, the market will eventually just force them to be more responsible. But Americans particularly, but probably most people in the world, require timely, relevant, solid information upon which to base their decisions every day. And if you go without it, it's kind of like this power outage we're going through now. You know, I automatically reach for a light switch that's not there anymore. So you can't, we don't notice it, but it's a really important part of our life to have solid, reliable, trustworthy information. And somehow, I think that we, the people, will find a way to force that.
Jeannie?
I couldn't agree more. And that's exactly what we try to do all over the world, because we believe everyone everywhere deserves that information that helps them make good choices for their families and participate in their communities and hold their governments to account. We're going to get there because we need it. We want it. And it's so important to our lives.
Lawton, thank you so much for your call. Janet on Facebook writes, I started posting, quote, when you hit forward or share, you assume responsibility for the veracity of what you post. Fact check, since I am sure you would not want to spread lies. I started this in 2008 and lost friends because of it. All right. So we'll go to Steve calling from Auburn. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I wonder if you could speak briefly about the repeal or the lifting of the Propaganda Act in 2013 and how that may have played into some of the fake news and people being responsible for the fake news that they are spreading. If you could just give us a little enlightenment on that, that would be great.
Chet is shaking his head. Jeannie, I can't see you. Is this something you don't know?
I'm not familiar with that either.
Yeah.
No.
Oh, so sorry about that, Steve. We have an email from Tim. It seems to be a constitutional nightmare to regulate free speech on those platforms. But could prohibition of official campaign advertising in social media at least help mitigate the disturbance of fake news in elections? Also, that would help lawmakers have an avenue to police campaigns and their ability to pay for the spread of disinformation. So Tim's idea, just say you can't advertise if you're a political campaign on social media. Chet, you're shaking your head.
No, that's not going to work, I'm afraid. It's so deeply built into the system that, I mean, people have been lying about other candidates since George Washington's days, and it's the ability to have as free and open and expressive exchange as possible, I think, is critical to our democracy. And, you know, you see it in these debates that the presidential candidates are having, and the profiles in the local newspaper recently about upcoming city council elections, that, you know, that's the kind of information that you just have to look at each candidate's approach and what they say and how they say it. And some of this is our responsibility in that critical thinking aspect we talked about earlier, to know what smells right and what doesn't.
An email from Greg. I was talking with my 30-year-old son about how difficult it is to find real news. His comment to me was, quote, "Papa, news is over." Jeannie, I suspect you beg to disagree.
Yeah, no, I do disagree. I think it's interesting. I think when we think about how to rebuild trust in the media, I think getting to as local a news as possible, getting back to what Chet was saying about being held accountable as a journalist, even thinking about you, Jennifer, people know who you are. MPB, Maine Public, is providing a service that we all know where to go if we disagree with something that you might be saying. And so as we slowly rebuild the trust in news, I think working and focusing at the local news level first, which is unfortunately the one that's being hit the hardest when it comes to the market forces against news, yeah. But I think reinvesting in local news, recommitting to making sure that we have the news that is most relevant to our lives available will slowly rebuild that trust around the world. News will never die.
And I must confess, speaking on behalf of no one, that my newspaper colleagues were not the quickest, most innovative people in the world when this threat started to arise. And I think the young man who was quoted is probably right for his generation, that the newspapers and the traditional sources have not remained relevant to them, and we need to look at how to make do that better.
I want to return to, for these last few minutes, to talking about the election. Bonnie on Facebook writes, "Don't count on social media. Do your homework on the candidates. People lead busy lives. How much homework are they expected to do? And how much might this affect the election, Jeannie?"
Well, I agree that people do need to do their homework, and they'll do as much as they're able to do and commit to do. The debates are in a fantastic format. Most election offices publish, you know, fantastic non-biased information. It's hard to answer that question, but I do think it depends on the individual. But we have an individual responsibility if we're going out to vote.
And I would add that you should do your homework about where you're getting your homework, just to make sure that your
great point
that your sources are giving both sides of the issue.
Isn't part of the issue, though, Chet, that some of the, you know, people know NPR, people know the New York Times, people know the Portland Press Herald, but there are news outlets that are legitimate that didn't used to exist. For example, BuzzFeed. That's a silly name. It does not sound like a legitimate news organization, but it is.
Look, I'm a grizzled old ink-stained newspaper guy. But if newspapers stopped killing trees, it wouldn't be the worst thing that ever happened in American history. I don't care what the platform is. You need to abide by these traditional values, not necessarily the traditional delivery systems.
Okay. Well, such an interesting conversation. I can't believe it's over. The voice you just heard, Chet Lunner, former Maine newspaper editor. He served in various positions with the federal government, including with Homeland Security, and Jeannie Burgo, who is president of the nonprofit news organization InterNews. One of our callers mentioned Snopes. Off the top of your head, do either one of you want to throw another fact-checking website out there that our audience might like to hear?
PolitiFact is good. NewsGuard is good.
NewsGuard, Snopes. Okay. Lucy Suchek ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.